Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here. We're looking at growing vegetables and fruit on the program today. And with us, once again, Kevin Chesso. He is the UW Extension Area Agriculture Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. As part of his job, he oversees the Spooner Research Station, and he'll tell us about his work there and also what becomes of all the food they produce. And, of course, we'll take your comments and questions as we move along. Are you having problems with your veggies or your fruit trees or plants this year? Questions about how to establish healthy soil? Join in. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Kevin Chesso, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. As always, a pleasure. It's been a little while, and so glad to be back on.
Yeah, it has been a while. And you've been, speaking of a while, you've been working at the Spooner Research Station for a while, quite a while now. Tell us about your work there.
Sure. Actually, I started here in my position with UW Extension, and I'm still employed by UW-Madison Division of Extension. And I started my partnership here at the Spooner Ag Research Station in January of 1999. So this is my 25th season of getting to partner with UW-Madison CALS. So the College of Ag and Life Sciences are the overseeing college, I guess, that manages the research station. So just to correct what you had said earlier, I'm not necessarily the person in charge. That would fall on my colleague, Phil Holman. And Phil is the research station superintendent, you know, overall manager of the property, all the things that have to happen to keep this place operating. And he also oversees the research projects that are on the station. So he's kind of the overall property manager. And then I partner with the research station to do my work and the extension outreach that accompanies with that. So I'm very unique in that my office is located right here at the Spooner Ag Research Station, just east of downtown Spooner, if you will. And the station has been here since 1909. And like all the research stations that are across the state, we have varied focused projects and missions, but it's to support research from primarily UW-Madison faculty, staff, and other university partners. But on occasion, we will moonlight and do other projects for a local business, private companies, that kind of stuff. So I've had the really unique opportunity to be involved personally with research in partnership with Cal. So the vegetable side is where I like to pay attention, right?
For the most part. Tom in Madison has a question for you already. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Larry. Earlier this summer, when they began doing closeouts at the nursery, I purchased two small boxwoods, two small barberries, and two small butterfly bushes that, unfortunately, I didn't put in the ground yet. I'm wondering, should I still put them in the ground, or should I bring them in the house and let them overwinter and kind of nurture them inside? I just don't want them to die on the deck or in the garage for lack of having been planted.
And sure. You're in, yep. And Tom's in Madison, so southern.
Okay. Yeah. Well, anytime we have a living, plant, it's got those basic needs. We obviously have to make sure it maintains, water, light, nutrients. And if it's been living in a pot, I can almost guarantee you that it's going to be root bound. And root-bound plants always have a disadvantage in the fact that they're stuck into this container and roots start going round and round, and we get this concept called root girdling, which really can be problematic if we don't get that plant out of the pot into either a larger container or find a permanent place to plant it or even a temporary place. So anytime we can get those plants out of the pot into a larger area where their roots can, you know, maybe explore and grow out, and, you know, it's just much more healthy and less stressful. So, you know, I'm assuming the plants are still looking somewhat healthy. And now you have to decide, how do I keep them alive until you find a permanent spot? If you have that permanent spot, I would go ahead and get them in the ground right now. No sense waiting. But certainly you want to knock that pot, you know, that plant out of the pot. And if you got to take a pruners and cut through some of those roots and pry them apart and get some of those circling roots removed, because they have like a tendency to be fixed in that circular pattern with the pot, and they'll continue to kind of grow in a circle and not necessarily explore surrounding soil. So you really got to not be shy in disturbing some of that root ball. And then just do all the right proper planting techniques, you know, make sure the roots have a place to go, and water and mulch, and keep them hydrated right up until the fall frost. Hopefully, you know, they establish and, you know, you have success in, you know, in the coming years, because they're all perennials, and just have to cross your fingers that, you know, they're going to be happy. But
frost, actually frost, probably up till ground freezes would be in terms of watering.
Yes. Plant roots, you know, perennials, they'll survive down into the 20s as far as soil temperatures go. So even though the top layer might be frozen because it's 32 and the ground is, you know, hard, the subsoil will always be a few degrees warmer. And if you got mulch, then the soil temperature can be maintained at maybe even 26 or 28 all winter long. And those plant roots are perennials, right? So they're going to be alive, and we need to take that into consideration and water and hydrate right up until the ground is frozen is kind of our recommendation.
Yep, absolutely. Tom, good luck. Get your shovel out and get started right after the show's over, of course. thanks for calling. Charles in Fall Creek, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Charles.
Morning, Larry. I was wondering if you guys could talk on a related subject. I rent, so I have a lot of my plants in pots, and I've tried to have different vegetables, but there's a lot of them that don't work out very well in pots. And I was hoping your guests could talk about what kind of fruits and vegetables are best suited for pots. I've had good luck with peppers. And then, you know, related to the last caller, how do you know when those plants are ready for a bigger pot?
Sure. Well, it always starts with understanding the plant and what it wants to be, if you will, when it grows up. You know, what's that mature plant size? And, you know, vegetables, most of them are annuals, and they'll complete their life cycle, you know, by this time of year. But if it's a vining type plant, like, you know, a tomato that wants to keep growing and flowering, and, you know, that can get 3-4 feet tall and spread another 2 feet. So the ultimate decision on what pot to use and how much soil that plant will need to have a healthy life depends on that individual plant's, you know, size. So container gardening is something I've been doing for many, many years on my back deck. I do it for a bunch of reasons. Deer browse, rabbit browse. I bring all that produce right outside my back sliding door and have it on my deck. Now, that doesn't prevent squirrels and chipmunks. They love those pots, and they'll dig in them and bury nuts and cause problems. But for the most part, it's in an area where I don't have to worry about the deer browse. And the downside is you got to water every day, sometimes twice a day when it's hot. So container gardening is definitely something I encourage people to try. Containers have to have holes in the bottom. The potting soil needs not to be, don't use native soil. Mix it with sphagnum moss, compost. Buy a potting mix that's very porous with perlite and vermiculite, you know, because the compaction will happen from all the watering and the settling of the soil. So as far as, you know, when to transplant, again, if you start with a large enough pot in the spring for annual vegetables, you should be fine. Now, if you're talking a perennial plant, that can get a little tricky because now that pot is going to be exposed to the winter. And if we have sub-zero temperatures, we don't have the insulation around that pot if it's sitting above ground. So we need to either heal that pot in or mulch way around it. So I don't do any container gardening with perennials. All of mine are annuals. And I, you know, once they're done, I knock the soil out, compost the plant material, and save my potting soil and then regenerate it in the following spring. So I kind of recycle my potting soil and amend it, add, you know, more sphagnum moss or compost and make sure it's got the nutrients it needs. So container gardening is certainly something more people should try. And you can grow a little bit of food or a lot of food in containers right outside your door. So
what food do you grow in containers then? What vegetables? Charles is, you know, has luck with some and not others.
Yeah, peppers and tomatoes are fail safes. Again, knowing, you know, how big that tomato is going to get. There's bush varieties of tomatoes and ones that are made specifically for containers. And UW Extension has a publication specific to container garden plants and certain varieties that work well in containers. So peppers and tomatoes, again, you're going to need at least 5 gallons, if not larger container. Whatever that is, you can recycle stuff, make sure it's got the drainage hole. But I love to do lettuce and kale and mustard plants. The garden greens work wonderful in containers. You got a little dappled shade maybe from being on the back deck where there's not full sun all the time. But I eat salad literally every day from mid-May up until, you know, the final killing frost in October. So those leafy vegetables work really well in containers. But again, water is important, and you got to be around to do that. So those are my mainstays. Herbs, you know, those you can bring inside, you know, a lot of those herbs and even some of the leafy greens. You know, you might get them in a south-facing window in October and November and keep that going for a couple months. But I really like the stuff that I'm going to eat and enjoy, and I like to cook. You know, peas and radishes and carrots, those are things that I'd rather do in ground. So just start with the plants you like to eat and see how they do in containers and learn as you go.
Yeah, and Charles said he had good luck with the peppers. He certainly would have, I would think, have good luck with tomatoes, and especially zeroing in on those that are specifically bred for being in pots.
Right. Yep.
There you go, Charles. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. What about you? Questions? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in for Garden Talk. Just to let you know, in the last half hour of the show today, we'll talk about the Savannah Institute. It's having its upcoming perennial farm gathering, and we'll talk about the Institute and that gathering. It's an organization that helps promote agroforestry. It's a really interesting concept, and I know you're going to enjoy that. Right now, though, we're talking with Kevin Chesso, UW Extension Area Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Great to have him with us. And questions, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. And an email, why is it important to have a research station in the northern part of the state, and what zone are you in there?
Yes, well, of course, I'm going to be a huge advocate of maintaining research facilities all across the state. But, you know, I've called northwestern Wisconsin home for most of my adult life. And, you know, our climate, our soils, our growing conditions are unique, just like other areas of the state. So having research facilities that are managed to do in the ground, you know, regional adapted research is how we can maintain relevant data that people who are living in these regions can say, oh, okay, that's research didn't come out of, you know, southern Wisconsin or, heaven forbid, another state or down Texas or something, right? So we need to do research that's in areas of the state where people live and work and have farms and whatnot. So that's a big part of that. As far as our climate and our zone, I think everybody's aware that the USDA came out with a new plant hardiness zone map, and a big part of Wisconsin got transitioned from zone 3 to zone 4. So we are now considered zone 4A. There's little tiny pockets of zone 3 still around. You know, I always tell people, you know, don't jump on the zone 4 bandwagon just yet. Let's slowly adapt and learn what plants do well in zone 4. But one of the things that we are discovering is that, you know, because of climate change, we can grow plants more reliably. And the data and the research that we're collecting from plant materials grown here suggests that. So when I first started here in 1999, I had the pleasure to work with Bob Tomich, and I don't know, Larry, you probably remember Bob, and he would bring plant materials to Spooner, and he'd group them in pairs, obviously, you know, perennial type plants, and he would say, well, take it to Spooner and see if we can kill it, right? See how cold hardy our plants are. So we've been doing that for many years, and as we've gone through the decades, we are now seeing some of our varietals, and I'm thinking more with some of our perennial fruits, i.e. grapes. We've had grapes on the research station since I've been here and even before. These are all cold hardy varieties. And there are now varieties that we used to not recommend that we are now successfully growing here. And the research continues with new varieties as those come on board to look at, all right, what are some of the known varieties of table grapes. Right now we've got a plot of table grapes, and there's varieties that have done well in say Madison, but we never really thought they would work up here. And well, now we have a vineyard with some of those southern varieties here, as well as new developing plant materials from University of Minnesota, I believe, for cold hardiness in the table grape side. So the research stations definitely serve a purpose in helping answer some of those questions about new materials and, you know, which plants are appropriate, and, you know, not just horticulture plants, but, you know, agricultural crops as well.
And as an aside, I'm glad you mentioned Bob Tomich. Bob was a guest on this program many, many times, rest his soul, and always a great guy to have on, and he knew an awful lot. Mary in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Help. I know this is a little off subject, but this is really a big problem. We have land around, we're in town, but have some land, quite a bit of land, really, around the house. But we have woodchucks. And the woodchucks are going underneath the earth, of course, and eating everything they run into, including bulbs and anything else like that. And we've got some tomatoes now. I see somebody's planted that they're after the – and I saw the woodchuck investigating the tomatoes. And I don't know. I have a dim view of the survival of that tomato. So, but I don't know. Do you know anything about woodchucks? And is there?
So you get to experience Groundhog's Day every day, huh? With that sighting. Yes. This gets back to my comment earlier about, you know, gardening with our native, neighbors, i.e. wildlife. And, you know, woodchucks, you know, they're one of our largest rodents. I'm not, you know, the wildlife expert. We have one, Drake. What's his first name?
David Drake,
and he's been on the show before too. But basically, anytime we're dealing with a critter, we have to decide how do we encourage it to take up residency somewhere else, right? So ideally, if we could encourage that groundhog to find other places to live, thus the problem should go away. But how do you do that? You know, you can trap and remove, but now where do you take it? You know, and, you know, most of us would rather do non-lethal management of pests. And, you know, a larger animal like a woodchuck certainly would not be my first choice to go after with any kind of lethal options. But if you can trap it and relocate it, I think that would be a wonderful starting point. But to try to deny it access to your gardens and to your landscape, that could be a real challenge too, because they're great at digging and burrowing and, you know, they're just doing their thing and they're designed to do that. So, you know, there are ways you can trap, and David Drake would have all those options, and you can go online maybe and look on how to trap woodchucks and live trapping, and perhaps, you know, you are successful in that, you can put them on a relocation project someplace else. So that would be my first recommendation. You know, trying to barricade them out is another option, but now you're talking, you know,
a lot of work.
Yeah. And then lethal is not my preferred option at all. So, yeah. You know, trapping and relocation would be the best. It's unfortunate.
Yeah. There you go, Mary. Thanks for calling. Kathy in Trempolo, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry. So my husband and I were introduced or discovered buttercup squash a couple years ago. And so last year we planted it. We had a great success. It was wonderful. It was sweet. This year, I don't know if it was the squash bugs or too much rain, but they didn't survive at all. So we bought one from a farmer's market the other day, and we're so excited to eat it. And it was watery and bland. It had no taste. So my question is, what for winter squash, are there certain conditions that you can, that make a sweeter, fleshier squash?
Well, yes. I mean, there's all kinds of variables that go into producing food and fruit, in this case with the mature winter, you know, squash. But variety selection is always our first choice, right? So you decide you want to grow a winter squash. You got to decide what seed are you going to, you know, purchase or acquire to get there, right? So variety selection is certainly plays a pretty big role in the overall flavor, texture, composition of the fruit, you know, how stringy it is or you know, if it's more watery or more dense. Our storage squashes typically have a little lower water content, so that gives them a different texture and taste, but they'll store longer. So seed selection or variety selection is the first thing. And there are a number of storage squash or winter squash varieties that are very sweet compared to what I maybe used to eat. And now through my experiences, I found varieties that I like because of the way they taste. So that's first thing. And then growing conditions obviously play a role too. When a plant is stressed, they will cause the fruits to maybe get off flavor, and there might be alkaloid compounds and other, phenols and chemistries that the plant creates when it's stressed. And that can now impart some off flavors in our fruit if it's too stressed. So making sure it's, adequately watered, and there's all that fertility stuff. And, this is just general gardening practices for all vegetables is, we got to make sure they're in healthy soil and they have adequate nutrients and water and sunlight. And then beyond that, there are, environmental things that will stress that plant, like I said, and some years we can't do a lot about that, but water would be one. Make sure they're adequately watered, and if you can't do that, that might impact the fruit quality. So,
and if you get too much water, you're going to get, you may get squash that are blander.
Yes. Again, it's, all about moisture management and what, I always tell people who garden, they say, all we're doing is repackaging water into different vessels, right? a watermelon is 95%+ water, right? And it takes water to create these, this food, but it's a balance, right? You don't want to have too much. You don't want to have too little. And then on top of it, too much water, not enough. You get diseases that can impact the leaves and the plants go down prematurely. Diseases on plants cause additional stress. That could impart off flavors in the fruit as well. And every year is different. And just keep that in mind. If this is your only first or second year growing a new vegetable, keep with it. Every year is going to present different challenges, and this might have been one of those seasons where the squash growing conditions on your property was slightly different than the year before, and now you have to learn from that. So I just keep trying and try new varieties every year.
Of the same squash. Kathy, what was the squash you were most interested in? Was butternut?
No, it was a buttercup.
Okay.
Yep. And the buttercup tend to be a little drier than, say, maybe an acorn. If they're a storage variety that are meant to store long, they'll be even a little drier. But the flavors in some of those buttercups that I've, I can't necessarily say a specific variety, but there's all kinds of them out there. And just try. Try some of the older ones. Try some of the brand new F1 hybrids. They're bred specifically for flavor. And one of the things we've done here at the research station is specifically looked at varieties of vegetable that are being bred and selected specifically for flavor. Because as we discover why people don't like vegetables, it might be because they're too bland. And so the genetics play a role in how that works too. So
And so Kathy, that farmer that you bought the squash from might have had a variety that was not one of those varieties that was bred for flavor. You never know unless you ask the variety. If you see that person again, just ask what that variety was and mention to that person that it seemed kind of bland and see what they say. It would be worth it. It was a farmer's market, so that person may still be out there. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You've got that display garden up there, and what are visitors going to see when they stop by the display gardens?
Well, like all gardens, it changes weekly, right? Two-thirds of the garden is annual plants. So in the spring, you're not going to see much yet, but come July and August, when everything's planted with our annuals, you will see a pretty wide display of both vegetables and flowers. But we have a monarch and pollinator garden, which is a perennial space, and that's rocking and rolling right now with all kinds of pollinators and butterflies. I think the monarch migration is starting because our monarchs numbers seem to be up right now, and that might be as they're preparing for that flight south. But we have, we're also an All America Selections display garden. So we feature those plants. We always try to do heirlooms and some of the more traditional, maybe open pollinated varieties. We do a little bit of research in the garden every year through the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative and Seed Linked. So if there's gardeners out there who want to do backyard garden research, the Seed to Kitchen and Seed Link project do just that. You can get small packets of seeds. You got to have a certain amount of space to do it. But we dedicate a bed or two every year to peppers and tomatoes. And then, of course, we've got our row of wine grapes, our row of table grapes, a couple of hop plants on display so people can see just how vigorous those are, a couple of apple trees. But it's really there for display and outreach and teaching. We've got tons of signage. I'm a big fan of teachable moments. And if we can put up a little sign, let people know what they're looking at. I've got a series of Wisconsin pollinator posters or signs that I created that I'm trying to, you know, make sure people know about so they can promote pollinators with these signs. So it's really diverse and it's always changing, of course, because of the time of year. And we had a small killing frost about 2 weeks ago, but for the most part, all the plants are still doing well.
You know, I like those signs because in this day and age with our phones and our cameras on our phones, you can, if you see something you like, you can take a photo of the sign and a photo of the plant or plants, and you got it.
Yeah, we got QR codes on some of those signs too. And, you know, it's all about just getting people excited about gardening and letting them see, you know, stuff. It's a lot of work. It's not something that most people are going to reproduce in their properties, but we do it just like I do at home. No sprays, very little chemical inputs from commercial fertilizers. We try to use organic practices. And to that end, we really took it on the shorts this year with the Japanese beetles on our grapes. But I tell you what, Larry, talk about a trap crop, because that's one of the concepts we talk about when managing pests is like, if you can't beat them, eat them, or let them eat on some plants you don't necessarily care about, so they stay off of your valuable, you know, plants. And they sure love grapes.
So they do indeed. They do.
That was our sacrifice, but I didn't do any green shoot pruning on those grapes this year, because the Beatles did it for me.
Linda in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi. So I have a question. I have a small vegetable garden. It's 10 by 16. I've had it for a few years now. And my question to you is, do you recommend rototilling? I want to put in some more compost and garden soil and kind of beef up the soil a little. Do you recommend rototilling that in, or should I just use like a rake and maybe a shovel or a hoe?
Yeah, and this is where gardening can be really personal and personalized. So, you know, 10 by 16, that's not a massive amount of square footage, but it's still enough area to plant and grow a bunch of food. And I don't know if you are into raised bed gardening or establishing raised beds as a practice in that space, or do you, is it pretty much bare ground and you plant in long, you know, linear rows?
Yeah, it's pretty much bare ground, though I do have a wooden frame around it because I mulched around it for walking and working around the garden. So,
okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure, so so that the raised bed concept I really like because you can reach into the beds and don't have to be walking all over, and you don't necessarily have to even do a lot of tillage because you can do it all with a shovel or a broad fork and really reduce the amount of tillage through more aggressive means like with a rototiller. And we haven't used a rototiller, a standard walk-behind rototiller, in our teaching display garden for probably 10 years. We've got a big rototiller we'll use on our bigger beds once in a while, but all of our smaller beds, we're just using hand tools and mixing and turning and adding our amendments that way. So I'm a big fan of adding organic matter. Nothing wrong with, you know, adding compost or mulches or, you know, composted manures. Any organic matter is a good thing to a point. So, you know, you might take a look at that space and say, well, I want to keep doing it the same way I've always done it. But can you do it without doing a lot of unnecessary pulverizing, I call it, with a rototiller? And that's a decision everybody has to come to, because, you know, change is sometimes not as easy to come by with some people. They like the way the soil looks after rototilling. Everything's uniform and you can rake it smooth, but you don't have to. And if you want to try rethinking that with some raised beds and just making, you know, mounds of soil and gardening in those and then have walking paths in between, that's certainly an option too. So, I would say, you know, keep enjoying your garden space. And if you want to, you know, use your rototiller, keep doing it. But there are other ways you might want to try to make it maybe a little more.
I think the rototiller kind of beats up the soil sort of.
Yeah. Yep. And we're changing our tune all the time on this, Larry, right? Because research shows that, you know, when we really aggressively, you know, rototill, we're breaking up some of that structure that supports our soil life. And the mycorrhizal fungi and the other organisms that call the soil home get, you know, they lose that home when we rototill. And then there's a compaction layer that forms eventually if you're doing it year after year after year. You know, so it's just a different way of thinking about it. And try a spot in the garden where you don't do much tillage. And, you know, it's a transition, but we can do it. We don't have to till if we don't want to. But there's times when you got to mix in organic matter with the tiller, and that's fine too.
Kevin Chesso, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Coming up on Monday, you can join us when our weather guys come back to talk climate and weather. And also then Bassam Jakashiri is with us to talk all things science and answer your science questions as well. Right now on Garden Talk, Kevin Chesso, UW Extension Area Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties, our guest. We've been zeroing in on veggies today and soil and water. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Judy in Delavan next. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have a volunteer butternut squash. Grew out of my compost pile. And I'm not sure when it's ripe enough to harvest. Do you wait till the tendril opposite the fruit is dry, or I don't want to harvest it too soon?
You know, we had a farmer call in, Kevin, to talk about the winter squash earlier that we were talking about, and that caller had said, well, that squash was kind of bland, and the farmer called to say winter squash needs 3 nights in a row of 45 degrees or colder temperatures to bring out the sweetness. And she says the squash the caller bought probably didn't get that.
This is a very good point. That's why I love the listeners. They can always remind us of some of these facts that maybe we don't talk about initially, but you are, that person is absolutely correct. You know, winter squash means it, you know, you harvest it in late fall and it goes, you know, stores into the winter. And the environment in how that squash ripens definitely will change the, you know, the flavor and texture of that as we go into fall. So once the plant dies, you know that it's done feeding that fruit. But the weather conditions, as indicated, will sweeten that, you know, the colder temperatures at night. In the warm, you know, and you got to cure it as well so that it stores. So getting back to the caller's question, you know, one of the things that I always look for in a lot of our vine crops, especially watermelon and squash, is, you know, you got the size, you know, and it matures to a certain size. So we have that. And then there's the coloration of the rind. And if it looks like it's the right color for that variety, or what you're assuming it should look like. And then there's this thing we call the ground spot. You know, that's another indication of that fruit becoming more mature or closer to finishing. So you'll see a little halo differentiation of colors between the top of the plant that's exposed to sun and the bottom that's now in the shade. And that ground spot, the more contrast there is to that ground spot to the rest of the squash, indicates that you're approaching full maturity as well. The corkiness of the stem is another indication. Sometimes people on melons will look for the tendrils closest to the stem, and if they're curled up and dry, the thump test, you know, all of those things are good indicators of how far you are. You know, you can always pick one and have that your sacrifice, if you will. And if you think it's really, really close to harvest and you've got a bunch of them, pick one and look at, cut it open and look at the flesh and look at the seed pocket. And if everything looks like it's fully mature, and if it tastes fine, well, then that's a decision on when to harvest. But most of our winter squash should be cured, should go through a killing frost. Again, not 20 degrees, but a light frost shouldn't hurt them. Maybe you cover them up and let them kind of cure out in the field and experience some of those temperature changes that will finish that to a nice ripe, you know, flavor. A volunteer squash coming out of the compost, we don't know what the genetics are behind that, what color it's supposed to be. So we have a little more challenge in figuring out what that wants to be when it's done. But I would let it go right up until we get killing frost and just leave it finished. And that way, you know, for sure.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. Judy, so you got a little bit of time to go yet. Thanks for calling. Francis in Barneveld, your turn. Hi, Francis.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I got an asparagus bed that I planted 5-6 years ago. And last winter, something got in it and burned holes. And this spring, we got no root, no asparagus at all. I'm wondering what kind of animal goes in there and burrows down, and do they eat the roots?
Now, is this were these small holes, like a gopher hole, or were these just dug up?
Well, they were kind of like gophers, I thought.
Okay.
Right. Larry, you've heard me say this before in past shows years ago, too, is, you know, now we're after horticulture CSI, right? Crime scene investigation. And some of those leading questions, like Larry started with, help us decide, you know, some of this yes, no, what might be going on? How did this happen? You know, the crime scene is there. We know something happened. Now let's just put on that investigator's cap and say, what evidence, what signs, symptoms, you know, what do we see that will help us look for likely suspects, right? So there should be some eating, chewing, you know, whatever you can see from that damage helps us decide, are we talking a rodent, something with teeth, chompers, something that can, you know, leave some kind of telltale sign that it was a rodent. If it's an insect, that's a little bit different. And if it happened underground and it's a big enough disturbance, my guess is we're talking some kind of mammal, rodent type critter that has the ability to dig and has, you know, teeth that are going to, you know, chew on stuff and cause, you know, problems. And now once that crown is kind of eaten and the buds for that plant are gone, you know, it might outright kill a perennial, you know, root like asparagus. But my guess is if it's an established plant, there should be underground buds that will survive. Maybe this year was a bust and you didn't get much, but I wouldn't quite give up on that and see if you can't let that plant recuperate. But if it's a reoccurring problem, you got to figure out how do you stop that. And, you know, trapping, like we said with the woodchuck, you know, it's always an option to try to, you know, get the mammal away or other means to discourage it from coming back. But I would continue to do some horticulture CSI and see if you can't put the pieces of the puzzle together and figure out what actually caused the damage.
Yeah. And if it was a gopher or something like it, you know, you could use some lethal methods if you wanted, but you still have to be careful because you could, you know, a trap out there could also attract a bird or something too. So there's a lot to think about there, Francis. But I think I'm guessing a small mammal that got in there. But I like Kevin's idea to let it go a year and see if, you know, the plants are going to come back. I think that's a good idea. So give it a try and see what you think. And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kevin, I want to go back to the Seed to Kitchen collaboration, because I think that's worth talking about. And a few minutes before we break for news, can you talk about that?
Sure. Like I said, I've been very fortunate to have this partnership with the research station and the property. And obviously the teaching and display garden is a separate outreach component of what I've done all these years. But this is a research station and we do research for, you know, all kinds of reasons. So the Seed to Kitchen collaborative was started by Julie Dawson a number of years ago. And it's since, you know, there's a bunch of collaborators with different universities and every state kind of figures out how do they want to address local foods. And in this case, Seed to Kitchen incorporates from the seed to the kitchen, meaning there are chefs that got involved right from the get-go, and they use those chefs and their culinary taste buds to help them decide what varieties and what kind of breeding projects they wanted to work on to enhance flavor. So chefs have that intuitive, you know, skill in figuring that out. So when they started this project, they worked with plant breeders and they said, we're going to take a really good, productive, solid variety like, for instance, Wisconsin Lakes pepper, very well-known pepper. Let's cross that with a variety called Dohill, which has this very unique flavor. The chefs just said that would be the match made in heaven if we can get both of those combinations into a new selection. So that's kind of how this whole process starts. They do an initial cross, then they save the seeds and we grow them out in our research plots, replicated. We collect data on them as they mature and as they come to fruition, we, you know, do yields, but then the chefs and other tasters will evaluate which selections get dropped and which ones move forward. So it takes many, many years of this inbreeding, because once we make the original cross, those seeds are then saved and we let them self. They're called selfies from that point on. Open pollen. And the goal is, as time goes on, we cull out those plants that are not appropriate for whatever reason, and flavor being one of them. So we keep selecting out for flavor and production and growth habit. And the next thing you know, we've got a new variety that can be offered to the public. So we're at. And if you Seed the Kitchen, you'll find more information on that. Or SeedLink is the other partner.
And we can talk some more about that. We're going to take a quick look at the news. Kevin Chesso, our guest today, and he'll be with us for another half hour at least. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kevin Shesso, UW Extension Area Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. We've been zeroing in today on especially on vegetables with Kevin, also talking about the Spooner Research Station. But questions, what's going on in your garden? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Kevin, you know, I want to talk a little bit more about the projects that you have going on at the Spooner Experimental Farm. And the uses of the produce, which I think is really interesting. Some of the produce, I mean, it's for teaching people about gardening, but there's other uses as well.
You bet. There's a teachable moment in everything we do, right? And touch, and when we're gardening, I look at that cucumber or that tomato, especially if it's a little unique and different. You know, we certainly have some of that with our plant breeding projects that we get to experience here. And that's where I'm like, as an outreach educator, that's a conversation I can now have with any number of people about all different kinds of things from, you know, what in the world, I've never seen a white cucumber before, right? Or, oh, that's the most beautiful tomato. How, I've never seen one with those kind of stripes and colors and all. And then when they taste it, there's that, you know, experience as well. So you can start with any number of subjects and have those conversations. So one of the benefits of doing research is we have, you know, up to maybe 2 acres of production. And this is not something the average person is going to have access to. I get that. But all of us grow extra plants or extra produce that we now have to decide what to do. And I really just want to remind folks that there are so many organizations, individuals that we can share our produce with. And don't be afraid to reach out to some of those organizations in your local communities to do that. You know, from the pop-up food pantries that show up, the libraries are doing that. Churches have been doing this for a long time. Other organizations that are community-based, you know, will also, you know, provide outlets for some of that stuff. Certainly our food shelves. But where I've really made inroads, partially because of the unique opportunity with our produce, is the schools. So every school district, at least that I've reached out to, has some kind of teacher working on family and consumer science education. The old home ec when I was in school, but cooking classes, my goodness, what a better way to help students learn about local foods than donating a box of our produce. I call it a free SA, right? Not a CSA, but a free SA. It's a box with no numbers. It's, well, weights maybe, but we don't charge for it. It's just use it, enjoy it, let the kids experience some of these unique varieties. They may never see them in a local grocery store, but we can at least let them have that experience. So that's the outreach component of my free SA project. I contact local schools. Hey, would you be willing to, you know, take a delivery of plants? Now we got to get into the whole Uber delivery of these vegetables to the area school districts. But we've got volunteers, and they have, you know, just like the Meals on Wheels, we hook up with volunteers. They deliver them. Sometimes they're the spouse of the teacher or another family member or community member who's helping us get those fruits into the classroom. And then I let the teachers do their magic. But sometimes I go into the classroom and I explain a little bit about where food comes from, right? Mother Earth, sunshine, water, nutrients, and a thing called photosynthesis, right? You know, and it all starts with those kind of conversations, and then it leads to all kinds of interesting questions and curiosities. And now they get to eat things and cook. And you'd be surprised how easy it is to keep somebody's attention when you are talking food. So if there's a way other gardeners can do that, you know, reach out to some of these organizations and offer up some of your stuff. Now, you do have to be aware that they meet certain quality criteria. You know, all of our stuff is grown organically. I explain that. We still say wash before you eat it and all those things. But, you know, there's plenty of food, edible food, that we all have in excess. And it might just be sharing it with your neighbor or other organizations. Like I said, you know, it's just amazing how once word gets out, all of our stuff goes every week. And this time of year, because it's in the prime harvest, we have a high tunnel research, right? 180 tomato plants trellised all the way to the top. And we get 500 pounds of tomatoes out of that every week. Not everybody's going to do that. Obviously, it's subsidized labor with research and all the things we do here. But I'm paying it forward and getting that out into our community so it doesn't go to waste. And we can do that in our own backyards, too.
Well said. Bob in Sun Prairie, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Bob. What's on your mind?
Hey, Larry. I got a question, not necessarily for myself, but for my wife. My wife is a very prolific flower gardener. And in the past couple of years, she's had tremendous success. This is up in the Montello area. And basically what she does is she plants her annuals and some perennials and so on and subsidizes them with good old Miracle-Gro. And just last week, she came to me and she said, you know, I heard about this horse farm down the road, and I might be able to get some good old horse manure for fertilizer. And so I just want to hear your thoughts on that. I said, well, if you do that, you might be introducing all kinds of weed seed and things like that. And I said, if you're having success doing it the way you're doing it, then why? So anyway.
Okay. Well, I'm sure Kevin's got some comments on that.
Well, of course, you know, and like you ended your comment, you know, why are you doing it? What's the goal, right? So if you're successful in a gardening practice, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, kind of comment, right? But at the same time, why not, you know, challenge, you know, the way we garden and rethink some of our practices and maybe come up with reasons why we might want to try something different and adapt our gardening practices to include maybe using a more locally sourced fertilizer like your horse manure. But with that said, we certainly are putting ourselves at risk of introducing weed seeds and other changes in our soil and in our practices that we're not used to. And that's why I always say, if you're going to use organic manures or change your gardening practices, start small, keep it simple, right? And maybe do it on a small area and take a bushel basket of this manure and get it on a bed that maybe, you know, you think might benefit from that. And then see how that works compared to your standard practices using the Miracle-Gro. Horse manure is not nearly as concentrated in its nutrients. Obviously, it does have nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, other micronutrients, but at a much smaller concentration than the Miracle-Gro. So you might have to do a little of both, you know, because last thing I want to do is see your wife's success not be there in the future because all of a sudden she switched to this horse manure and everything went south, right? Let's do this very deliberately. Try a small area first and then learn as you go. So the horse manure will definitely increase your chance of bringing in weed seeds. If it's composted and it's a hot compost, we can sometimes reduce that. But invariably, we're going to be bringing in some of those unintended plants through our, you know, so But you've got organic matter. That carbon-based fertilizer is going to improve soil tilth, soil health. It's going to feed the microorganisms. And Miracle-Gro can only do the chemistry. It can only supply nutrients and not necessarily the organic pieces that come with, you know, horse manure.
Yeah.
Both will give you, you know, results you want, but it's, again, what's the end goal?
Stella in Sturgeon Bay actually has some experience to share with horse manure. So let's go to Stella. Hi, Stella.
Hi. When we lived in Missouri, there was a horse farm out just not far outside of town that we learned about. They used sawdust for bedding. They kept their horses in stalls all the time. They had this huge pile, I mean, it was almost as tall as the barn, of very well composted horse manure. And we just took trailer loads of that. We got permission from our landlord to make a garden in the backyard, and we took trailer loads of that. And our garden was just absolutely lush and wonderful. We do organic gardening. The thing with horse manure is horses are seeders. Seeds go through their gut unscathed, and they come out fertilized in the poop. So you need to make sure that it's well composted before you use it in your garden. But once it is well composted, it is absolutely wonderful.
Very good points, Stella. Thank you so much for calling. And really, on that earlier caller with the horse manure, that manure should be, if you compost it, Kevin, you're going to have a lot less, fewer problems. Let's put it that way.
Well, of course. And I always say, you know, understand the source and, of course, the pros and cons. And there's both, right? And Stella mentioned that with the fact that composting kind of breaks down some of those organic compounds that might tie up nutrients, like that sawdust she mentioned. No, the weed seeds, you really got to have a hot compost to eliminate those. But eventually, you know, some of those weeds might die out on their own if it's left long enough, like she indicated. And if you know the source of where you're, you know, if you go there and physically see the pile of manure, like she, you know, suggested, you feel a little more confident in what you're bringing home. And the older it is, the more composted it is, obviously, the better. And just know that there's always going to be that risk of bringing in unwanted, hitchhikers in mostly in the seeds, and just be prepared for that. But the long range benefits of adding organic matter to any soil is always going to be better than not. And I've told this before to you, Larry, and others, people, the three things I always suggest to do to improve most soil is, number one, add organic matter. Number two, try some more organic matter. And maybe number three, keep putting organic matter down. You know, there's so many good things. If you do it right, if you know the source, you can overdo it. Too rich a compost or too rich a manure, like poultry litter and poultry, you can get hot, you know, burn your plants with too much urea, you know, too much nitrogen. But in general, at least on a new garden bed, you know, adding organic matter is always going to be helpful to a certain point.
Yeah. Well, Mary in New London emailed, she has some small garden beds up against her house that haven't been touched for 20 years. She's in the process of removing the current plants, mostly irises, to make room for more natives. But the soil is so very hard. Any tricks for breaking it up? She's tried shovels, forks, hand trowels. It's really difficult to try to mix compost with the soil she has already broken up.
Yeah. So this is like remediation from a, you know, I don't say construction site. When we've got an abused soil, perhaps, is that's one way to look at it, where you now have physical and probably biological conditions that are not ideal. And, you know, physically, we need porosity. We need water retention, you know, and when it's compact and hard, we're not giving that soil the adequate, you know, structure it needs for roots to grow and help, you know, plants to be healthy. So, you know, physically, you're looking at just trying to do as much as you can to bust some of that soil, up. And again, if you really can't get it to a state you like, there's always the option of removing some of it and replacing it with something else, if it comes to that. But the addition of organic material over time should help plant roots to become established in that bed, and those plant roots might help break up some of that compaction. You've got water infiltration and some dissolving of minerals and just other physical chemical reactions that might soften that soil up over time. But it's going to take a while for that to mellow out, but increasing the organic matter and getting plant roots into that spot are one way to, you know, remediate it, short of, you know, excavating out and getting rid of the worst of the compaction and replacing it with something else. So, you know, not always simple to correct, you know, situations, but over time, you should be able to get that soil, you know, health to improve. And that's mostly with, like I said, the organic matter additions and plant roots and biology, soil life, working on that soil to bring it back. But it's not going to be overnight.
Community gardener in Eau Claire emailed, the last 2 years they've had their Brussels sprout plants grow very tall and leafy. However, the Brussels sprouts themselves do not grow large or dense. They opened up very early, have no viable Brussels sprouts. Last year was dry, this year was wet, though they did try and water well last year. Question, they use a heavy leaf mulch layer each fall, and their soil tends to be excellent. Besides too much nitrogen, is there anything else they should know about growing Brussels sprouts?
Ooh, yeah, I've always thought of Brussels sprouts as one of those specialty crops. It definitely is a long season crop, and you got to keep that in mind when you're selecting varieties. I'll get back to never hurts to try new varieties as another way to see if that might give you a little bit more success. But if you've got a tried true variety that always worked and all of a sudden it's not, well, then there's something else going on in the environment that might be causing the plant to not be as productive as it once was. So it's a cool season vegetable. You know, temperature might be some of the reason why those florets or little sprouts aren't forming like they should. Inadequate or uneven moisture might be causing some of that stress. If you've got otherwise healthy soil and you're not over fertilizing, that shouldn't be a factor to consider. Like I said, I'm not a big Brussels sprouts grower myself, and I like them. I like to grow them, but I don't know enough about the nuances that make one year different than the other, and how do you manage them so that the florets are there, if that's, you know, the issue. I don't know if there's insects that might be messing with them, or a little bit of disease that could cause the poor crop. You have to do a little bit more investigating on, you know, what is preventing that, because, you know, you have various diseases that could cause some of that. But I guess I'm just not as an experienced a Brussels sprout grower to know some of those tricks, right? I mean, you know, same with cauliflower. I mean, I hardly ever grow that for the same kind of reasons, because you got to know how to, you know, blanch the heads or keep them covered. And, you know, there's little tricks to some of these crops, and Brussels sprouts might just be one of those that's for, the more experienced. Keep asking around, talk to other experienced Brussels sprout growers. You know, somebody at a farmer's market that seems to be, you know, successful in bringing that to market, or, you know, other, you know, folks you might know. You can always go online and search, you know, Brussels sprout growing and management, UW Extension or .edu, and get some good university fact sheets on Brussels sprouts, and maybe there's something there you learn too.
Yeah, absolutely. Pam wonders, she wants to winterize her patio garden, largely pots, one raised rectangular bed. In the last minute or so, any advice there on winterizing?
Well, if you're going to be saving that soil and you don't want to dump it out, you know, and if they're not perennial plants in those pots, you know, you don't have to do much at all. I, like I said, have lots of pots. Once I remove the plant material, I just move them and stack them up and put them on the north side of my house by, you know, in a spot that's out of the way for the winter. And then come spring, I dump the soil out and start over. So if you've got plants in those pots that you want to overwinter, that's when we got to be really aware of the temperature that soil gets to over the winter, and providing some kind of insulation so those soil temperatures don't get, you know, into the low 20s, and then you're going to kill off roots because it, you know, just got too cold. But I don't think there's anything too extravagant as far as preparing those pots for winter if they're annuals, but perennials, definitely got to heal them in, bury them in the ground, provide a whole bunch of extra insulation, move them into a garage area that's still cold, but maybe doesn't get quite as cold. So that's, you know, I don't know if it explains the situation that she's in, but that's how I would look at containers.
Well, Kevin, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to another visit from you. Thank you, Kevin.
Well, always a pleasure, and if you're ever up this way, Larry, or anybody else, you know, Highway 53 goes right past, not that far from the Teaching and Display Garden, if folks want to check it out.
All right. Kevin Chesso, UW Extension Area Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Coming up, we're going to take a look at agroforestry. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News.